to protest his imprisonment, but all he could think about was Ava. She was a saint, a woman of destiny, a heroine. He wrote to her, "It is only being apart from loved ones that we can measure our affection. From the day I left you, I have not been able to calm my sad heart. My immense solitude is full of your memory." Now, he promised to marry her. The strikes grew in intensity. After 8 days, Perón was released from prison. He promptly married Eva. A few months later, he was elected president. As first lady, Eva attended state functions in her somewhat gaudy dresses and jewelry. She was seen as a former actress with a large wardrobe. Then, in 1947, she left for a tour of Europe, and Argentines followed her every move. The ecstatic crowds that greeted her in Spain, her audience with the Pope, and in her absence, their opinion of her changed. How well she represented the Argentine spirit, its noble simplicity, its flair for drama. When she returned a few weeks later, they overwhelmed her with attention. Eva, too, had changed during her trip to Europe. Now her dyed blonde hair was pulled into a severe chignon, and she wore tailored suits. It was a serious look, befitting a woman who was to become the savior of the poor. Soon her image could be seen everywhere, her initials on the walls, the sheets, the towels of the hospitals for the poor, her profile on the jerseys of a soccer team from the poorest part of Argentina, whose club she sponsored, her giant smiling face covering the sides of buildings. Since finding out anything personal about her had become impossible, all kinds of elaborate fantasies began to spring up about her. And when cancer cut her life short in 1952, at the age of 33, the age of Christ when he died, the country went into mourning. Millions filed past her embalmed body. She was no longer a radio actress, a wife, a first lady, but Evita, a saint. Interpretation. Eva Duarte was an illegitimate child who had grown up in poverty, escaped to Buenos Aires to become an actress, and had been forced to do many tawdry things to survive and get ahead in the theater world. Her dream was to escape all of the constraints on her future, for she was intensely ambitious. Perón was the perfect victim. He imagined himself a great leader, but the reality was he was fast becoming a lecherous old man who was too weak to raise himself up. Eva injected poetry into his life. Her language was florid and theatrical. She surrounded him with attention, indeed to the point of suffocation, but a woman's dutiful service to a great man was a classic image and was celebrated in innumerable tango ballads. Yet she managed to remain elusive, mysterious, like a movie star you see all the time on the screen but never really know. And when Perón was finally alone in prison, these poetic images and associations burst forth in his mind. He idealized her madly. As far as he was concerned, she was no longer an actress with a tawdry past. She seduced an entire nation the same way. The secret was her dramatic, poetic presence combined with a touch of elusive distance. Over time, you would see whatever you wanted to in her. To this day, people fantasize about what Eva was really like. Familiarity destroys seduction. This rarely happens early on. There is so much to learn about a new person. But a midpoint may arrive when the target has begun to idealize and fantasize about you, only to discover that you are not what he or she thought. It's not a question of being seen too often, of being too available, as some imagine. In fact, if your targets see you too rarely, you give them nothing to feed on, and their attention may be caught by someone else. You have to occupy their mind. It is more a manner of being too consistent, too obvious, too human and real. Your targets cannot idealize you if they know too much about you, if they start to see you as all too human. Not only must you maintain a degree of distance, But there must be something fantastical and bewitching about you, sparking all kinds of delightful possibilities in their mind. The possibility Eva held out was the possibility that she was what, in Argentine culture, was considered the ideal woman. Devoted, motherly, saintly. But there are any number of poetic ideals you can try to embody. Chivalry, adventure, romance, and so on are just as potent, and if you have a whiff of them about you, you can breathe enough poetry into the air to fill people's minds with fantasies and dreams. At all costs, you must embody something, even if it is roguery and evil. Anything to avoid the taint of familiarity and commonness. Keys to Seduction. We all have a self-image that is more flattering than the truth. We think of ourselves as more generous, selfless, honest, kindly, intelligent, or good-looking than, in fact, we are. It is extremely difficult for us to be honest with ourselves about our own limitations. We have a desperate need to idealize ourselves. As the writer Angela Carter remarks, we would rather align ourselves with angels than with the higher primates from which we are actually descended. This need to idealize extends to our romantic entanglements, because when we fall in love, or under the spell of another person, we see a reflection of ourselves. The choice we make in deciding to become involved with another person reveals something important and intimate about us. We resist seeing ourselves as having fallen for someone who is cheap or tacky or tasteless because it reflects badly on who we are. Furthermore, we're often likely to fall for someone who resembles us in some way. Should that person be deficient or, worst of all, ordinary, then there is something deficient and ordinary about us. No, at all costs, the loved one must be overvalued and idealized, at least for the sake of our own self-esteem. Besides, in a world that is harsh and full of disappointment, it is a great pleasure to be able to fantasize about a person you're involved with. This makes the seducer's task easy. People are dying to be given the chance to fantasize about you. Do not spoil this golden opportunity by overexposing yourself or becoming so familiar and banal that the target sees you exactly as you are. You don't have to be an angel or a paragon of virtue. That would be quite boring. You can be dangerous, naughty, even somewhat vulgar, depending on the tastes of your victim, but never be ordinary or limited. In poetry, as opposed to reality, anything is possible. Soon after we fall under a person's spell, we form an image in our minds of who they are and what pleasures they might offer. Thinking of them when we're alone, we tend to make this image more and more idealized. The novelist Stendhal, in his book On Love, calls this phenomenon crystallization, telling the story of how, in Salzburg, Austria, they used to throw a leafless branch into the abandoned depths of a salt mine in the middle of winter. When the branch was pulled out, months later, it would be covered with spectacular crystals. That is what happens to a loved one in our minds. According to Stendhal, though, there are two crystallizations. The first happens when we first meet the person. The second, and more important one, happens later, when a bit of doubt creeps in. You desire the other person, but they elude you. You're not sure they're yours. This bit of doubt is critical. It makes your imagination work double, deepens the poeticizing process. In the 17th century, the great rake, the Duc de Lauzun, pulled off one of the most spectacular seductions in history, that of the Grande Mademoiselle, the cousin of King Louis XIV, and the wealthiest and most powerful woman in France. He tickled her imagination with a few brief encounters at the court, letting her catch glimpses of his wit, his audacity, his cool manner. She would begin to think of him when she was alone. Next, she started to bump into him more often at the court, and they would have little conversations or walks. When these meetings were over, she would be left with a doubt. Is he or is he not interested in me? This made her want to see him more in order to allay her doubts. She began to idealize him all out of proportion to the reality, for the Duke was an incorrigible scoundrel. Remember, if you are easily had, you cannot be worth that much. It is hard to wax poetic about a person who comes so cheaply. If, after the initial interest, you make it clear that you cannot be taken for granted, if you stir a bit of doubt, the target will imagine there's something special, lofty, and unattainable about you. Your image will crystallize in the other person's mind. Cleopatra knew that she was really no different from any other woman, and in fact, her face was not particularly beautiful. But she knew that men have a tendency to overvalue a woman. All that is required is to hint that there is something different about you, to make them associate you with something grand or poetic. She made Caesar aware of her connection to the great kings and queens of Egypt's past. With Antony, she created the fantasy that she was descended from Aphrodite herself. These men were cavorting not just with a strong-willed woman, but a kind of goddess. Such associations might be difficult to pull off today, but people still get deep pleasure from associating others with some kind of childhood fantasy figure. John F. Kennedy presented himself as a figure of chivalry, noble, brave, charming. Pablo Picasso was not just a great painter with a thirst for young girls. He was the minotaur of Greek legend, or the devilish trickster figure that is so seductive to women. These associations should not be made too early. They're only powerful once the target has begun to fall under your spell and is vulnerable to suggestion. A man who had just met Cleopatra would have found the Aphrodite association ludicrous. But a person who is falling in love will believe almost anything. The trick is to associate your image with something mythic through the clothes you wear, the things you say, the places you go. In Marcel Proust's novel, Remembrance of Things Past, the character Swan finds himself gradually seduced by a woman who is not really his type. He is an aesthete and loves the finer things in life. She is of a lower class, less refined, even a little tasteless. What poeticizes her in his mind is a series of exuberant moments they share together, moments that from then on he associates with her. One of these is a concert in a salon that they attend, in which he is intoxicated by a little melody in a sonata. Whenever he thinks of her, he remembers this little phrase. Little gifts she has given him, objects she's touched or handled, begin to assume a life of their own. Any kind of heightened experience, artistic or spiritual, lingers in the mind much longer than normal experience. You must find a way to share such moments with your targets, a concert, a play, a spiritual encounter, whatever it takes, so that they associate something elevated with you. Shared moments of exuberance have immense seductive pull. Also, any kind of object can be imbued with poetic resonance and sentimental associations, as discussed in the last chapter. The gifts you give and other objects can become imbued with your presence. If they are associated with pleasant memories, the sight of them keeps you in mind and accelerates the poeticization process. Although it is said that absence makes the heart grow fonder, an absence too early will prove deadly to the crystallization process. Like Eva Peron, you must surround your targets with focused attention, so that in those critical moments when they're alone, their mind is spinning with a kind of afterglow. Do everything you can to keep the target thinking about you. Letters, mementos, gifts, unexpected meetings, all these give you an omnipresence. Everything must remind them of you. Finally, if your targets should see you as elevated and poetic, there's much to be gained by making them feel elevated and poeticized in their turn. The French writer Chateaubriand would make a woman feel like a goddess. She had such a powerful effect on him. He would send her poems that she supposedly had inspired. To make Queen Victoria feel as if she were both a seductive woman and a great leader, Benjamin Disraeli would compare her to mythological figures and great predecessors, such as Queen Elizabeth I. By idealizing your targets this way, You will make them idealize you in return, since you must be equally great to be able to appreciate and see all of their fine qualities. They will also grow addicted to the elevated feeling you give them. Reversal. It might seem that the reverse tactic would be to reveal everything about yourself, to be completely honest about your faults and virtues. This kind of sincerity was a quality Lord Byron had. He almost got a thrill out of disclosing all of his nasty, ugly qualities, even going so far later on in his life as to tell people about his incestuous involvements with his half-sister. This kind of dangerous intimacy can be immensely seductive. The target will poeticize your vices and your honesty about them. They will start to see more than is there. In other words, the idealization process is unavoidable. The only thing that cannot be idealized is mediocrity. But there is nothing seductive about mediocrity. There is no possible way to seduce without creating some kind of fantasy and poeticization. Chapter 13. Disarm Through Strategic Weakness and Vulnerability. Too much maneuvering on your part may raise suspicion. The best way to cover your tracks is to make the other person feel superior and stronger. If you seem to be weak, vulnerable, enthralled by the other person, and unable to control yourself, you will make your actions look more natural, less calculated. Physical weakness, tears, bashfulness, paleness, will help create the effect. To further win trust, exchange honesty for virtue. Establish your sincerity by confessing some sin on your part. It doesn't have to be real. Sincerity is more important than goodness. Play the victim, then transform your target's sympathy into love. The victim strategy. That sweltering August in the 1770s, when the Présidente de Tourvel was visiting the chateau of her old friend, Madame de Rosemonde, leaving her husband at home, she was expecting to be enjoying the peace and quiet of country life, more or less, on her own. But she loved the simple pleasures, and soon her daily life at the chateau assumed a comfortable pattern. Daily mass, walks in the country, charitable work in the neighboring villages, card games in the evening. When Madame de Rosemonde's nephew arrived for a visit then, the Présidente felt uncomfortable, but also curious. The nephew, the Vicomte de Valmont, was the most notorious libertine in Paris. He was certainly handsome, but he was not what she had expected. He seemed sad, somewhat downtrodden, and strangest of all, he paid hardly any attention to her. The Présidente was no coquette. She dressed simply, ignored fashions, and loved her husband. Still, she was young and beautiful and was used to fending off men's attentions. In the back of her mind, she was slightly perturbed that he took so little notice of her. Then, at mass one day, she caught a glimpse of Valmont, apparently lost in prayer. The idea dawned on her that he was in the midst of a period of soul-searching. As soon as word had leaked out that Valmont was at the chateau, the Présidente had received a letter from a friend warning her against this dangerous man. But she thought of herself as the last woman in the world to be vulnerable to him. Besides, he seemed on the verge of repenting his evil past. Perhaps she could help move him in that direction. What a wonderful victory that would be for God. And so the Présidente took note of Valmont's comings and goings, trying to understand what was happening in his head. It was strange, for instance, that he would often leave in the morning to go hunting, yet would never return with any game. One day she decided to have her servant do a little harmless spying, and she was amazed and delighted to learn that Valmont had not gone hunting at all. He had visited a local village where he had doled out money to a poor family about to be evicted from their home. Yes, she was right. His passionate soul was moving from sensuality to virtue. How happy that made her feel. That evening, Valmont and the Présidente found themselves alone for the first time, and Valmont suddenly burst out with a startling confession. He was head over heels in love with the Présidente, and with a love he had never experienced before. Her virtue, her goodness, her beauty, her kind ways had completely overwhelmed him. His generosity to the poor that afternoon had been for her sake, perhaps inspired by her, perhaps something more sinister. It had been to impress her. He would never have confessed to this, but finding himself alone with her, he could not control his emotions. Then he got down on his knees and begged for her to help him, to guide him in his misery. The Présidente was caught off guard and began to cry. Intensely embarrassed, she ran from the room and for the next few days pretended to be ill. She did not know how to react to the letters Valmont now began to send her, begging her to forgive him. He praised her beautiful face and her beautiful soul and claimed she had made him rethink his whole life. These emotional letters produced disturbing emotions, and Tourvel prided herself on her calmness and prudence. She knew she should insist that he leave the chateau and wrote him to that effect. He reluctantly agreed, but on one condition, that she allow him to write to her from Paris. She consented as long as the letters were not offensive. When he told Madame de Rosemonde that he was leaving, the Présidente felt a pang of guilt. His hostess and aunt would miss him, and he looked so pale. He was obviously suffering. Now the letters from Valmont began to arrive, and Tourvel soon regretted allowing him this liberty. He ignored her request that he avoid the subject of love. Indeed, he vowed to love her forever. He rebuked her for her coldness and insensitivity. He explained his bad path in life. It wasn't his fault. He had had no direction, had been led astray by others. Without her help, he would fall back into that world. "Do not be cruel," he said. "You are the one who seduced me. I am your slave, the victim of your charms and goodness. Since you are strong and do not feel as I do, you have nothing to fear." Indeed, the Présidente de Tourvel came to pity Valmont. He seemed so weak, so out of control. How could she help him? And why was she even thinking of him, which she now did more and more? She was a happily married woman. No, she must at least put an end to this tiresome correspondence. No more talk of love, she wrote, or she would not reply. His letters stopped coming. She felt relief. Finally, some peace and quiet. One evening, however, as she was seated at the dinner table, she suddenly heard Valmont's voice from behind her, addressing Madame de Rosemonde. On the spur of the moment, he said he had decided to return for a short visit. She felt a shiver up and down her spine. Her face flushed. He approached and sat down beside her. He looked at her, she looked away, and soon made an excuse to leave the table and go up to her room. But she could not completely avoid him over the next few days, and she saw that he seemed paler than ever. He was polite, and a whole day might pass without her seeing him, but these brief absences had a paradoxical effect. Now Tourvel realized what had happened. She missed him. She wanted to see him. This paragon of virtue and goodness had somehow fallen in love with an incorrigible rake. Disgusted with herself and what she had allowed to happen, she left the chateau in the middle of the night without telling anyone and headed for Paris, where she planned somehow to repent this awful sin. Interpretation. The character of Valmont in Chaudarlot de Laclos' epistolary novel, Dangerous Liaisons, is based on several of the great real-life libertines of 18th-century France. Everything Valmont does is calculated for effect. The ambiguous actions that make Tourvel curious about him, the act of charity in the village, he knows he's being followed, the return visit to the chateau, the paleness of his face. He is having an affair with a girl at the chateau, and their all-night carousals give him a wasted look. Most devastating of all is his positioning of himself as the weak one, the seduced, the victim. How can the Présidente imagine he is manipulating her when everything suggests he's simply overwhelmed by her beauty, whether physical or spiritual? He cannot be a deceiver when he repeatedly makes a point of confessing the truth about himself. He admits that his charity was questionably motivated. He explains why he's gone astray. He lets her in on his emotions. All of this honesty, of course, is calculated. In essence, he's like a woman, or at least like a woman of those times, emotional, unable to control himself, moody, insecure. She is the one who is cold and cruel like a man. In positioning himself as Tourvel's victim, Valmont can not only disguise his manipulations, but elicit pity and concern. Playing the victim, he can stir up the tender emotions produced by a sick child or a wounded animal. And these emotions are easily channeled into love, as the Présidente discovers to her dismay. Seduction is a game of reducing suspicion and resistance. The cleverest way to do this is to make the other person feel stronger, more in control of things. Suspicion usually comes out of insecurity. If your targets feel superior and secure in your presence, they're unlikely to doubt your motives. You're too weak, too emotional, to be up to something. Take this game as far as it will go. Flaunt your emotions and how deeply they have affected you. Making people feel the power they have over you is immensely flattering to them. Confess to something bad, or even to something bad that you did or contemplated doing to them. Honesty is more important than virtue, and one honest gesture will blind them to many deceitful acts. Create an impression of weakness. Physical, mental, emotional. Strength and confidence can be frightening. Make your weakness a comfort and play the victim of their power over you, of circumstances, of life in general. This is the best way to cover your tracks. Keys to Seduction. We all have weaknesses, vulnerabilities, frailnesses in our mental makeup. Perhaps we're shy or oversensitive or need attention. Whatever the weakness is, it's something we cannot control. We may try to compensate for it or to hide it, but this is often a mistake. People sense something inauthentic or unnatural. Remember, what is natural to your character is inherently seductive. A person's vulnerability, what they seem to be unable to control, is often what is most seductive about them. People who display no weaknesses, on the other hand, often elicit envy, fear, and anger. We want to sabotage them just to bring them down. Do not struggle against your vulnerabilities or try to repress them, but put them into play. Learn to transform them into power. The game is subtle. If you wallow in your weakness, overplay your hand, you will be seen as angling for sympathy, or worse, as pathetic. No, what works best is to allow people an occasional glimpse into the soft, frail side of your character, and usually only after they have known you for a while. That glimpse will humanize you, lowering their suspicions and preparing the ground for a deeper attachment. Normally strong and in control, at moments you let go, give in to your weakness, let them see it. Valmont used his weakness this way. He had lost his innocence long ago, and yet, somewhere inside, he regretted it. He was vulnerable to someone truly innocent. His seduction of the Présidente was successful because it wasn't totally an act. There was a genuine weakness on his part, which even allowed him to cry at times. He let the Présidente see this side to him at key moments in order to disarm her. Like Valmont, you can be acting and sincere at the same time. Suppose you're genuinely shy. At certain moments, give your shyness a little weight. Lay it on a little thick. It should be easy for you to embellish a quality you already have. After Lord Byron published his first major poem in 1812, he became an instant celebrity. Beyond being a talented writer, he was so handsome, even pretty, and he was as brooding and enigmatic as the characters he wrote about. Women went wild over Lord Byron. He had an infamous underlook, slightly lowering his head and glancing upward at a woman, making her tremble. But Byron had other qualities. When you first met him, you couldn't help noticing his fidgety movements, his ill-fitting clothes, his strange shyness, and his noticeable limp. This infamous man, who scorned all conventions and seemed so dangerous, was personally insecure and vulnerable. In Byron's poem Don Juan, the hero is less a seducer of women than a man constantly pursued by them. The poem was autobiographical. Women wanted to take care of this somewhat fragile man who seemed to have little control over his emotions. More than a century later, John F. Kennedy, as a boy, became obsessed with Byron, the man he most wanted to emulate. He even tried to borrow Byron's underlook. Kennedy himself was a frail youth, with constant health problems. He was also a little pretty, and friends saw something slightly feminine in him. Kennedy's weaknesses, physical and mental, for he too was insecure, shy, and oversensitive, were exactly what drew women to him. If Byron and Kennedy had tried to cover up their vulnerabilities with a masculine swagger, they would have had no seductive charm. Instead, they learned how to subtly display their weaknesses, letting women sense this soft side to them. There are fears and insecurities peculiar to each sex. Your use of strategic weakness must always take these differences into account. A woman, for instance, may be attracted by a man's strength and self-confidence, but too much of it can create fear, seeming unnatural, even ugly. Particularly intimidating is the sense that the man is cold and unfeeling. She may feel insecure that he is only after sex and nothing else. Male seducers long ago learned to become more feminine, to show their emotions and to seem interested in their targets' lives. The medieval troubadours were the first to master this strategy. They wrote poetry in honor of women, emoted endlessly about their feelings, and spent hours in their ladies' boudoirs, listening to the women's complaints and soaking up their spirit. In return for their willingness to play weak, the troubadours earned the right to love. Little has changed since then. Some of the greatest seducers in recent history, Gabriele D'Annunzio, Duke Ellington, Errol Flynn, understood the value of acting slavishly to a woman like a troubadour on bended knee. The key is to indulge your softer side while still remaining as masculine as possible. This may include an occasional show of bashfulness, which the philosopher Soren Kierkegaard thought an extremely seductive tactic for a man. It gives the woman a sense of comfort and even of superiority. Remember, though, to keep everything in moderation. A glimpse of shyness is sufficient. Too much of it, and the target will despair, afraid that she will end up having to do all the work. A man's fears and insecurities often concern his sense of masculinity. He usually will feel threatened by a woman who is too overtly manipulative, who's too much in control. The greatest seductresses in history knew how to cover up their manipulations by playing the little girl in need of masculine protection. A famous courtesan of ancient China, Su Shou, used to make up her face to look particularly pale and weak. She would also walk in a way that made her seem frail. The great 19th century courtesan Cora Pearl would literally dress and act like a little girl. Marilyn Monroe knew how to give the impression that she depended on a man's strength to survive. In all of these instances, the women were the ones in control of the dynamic, boosting a man's sense of masculinity in order to ultimately enslave him. To make this most effective, a woman should seem both in need of protection and sexually excitable, giving the man his ultimate fantasy. The Empress Josephine, wife of Napoleon Bonaparte, won dominance over her husband early on through a calculated coquetry. Later on, though, she held on to that power through her constant, and not so innocent, use of tears. Seeing someone cry usually has an immediate effect on our emotions. We cannot remain neutral. We feel sympathy and most often will do anything to stop the tears, including things that we normally wouldn't do. Weeping is an incredibly potent tactic, but the weeper is not always so innocent. There's usually something real behind the tears, but there may also be an element of acting, of playing for effect, and if the target senses this, the tactic is doomed. Beyond the emotional impact of tears, there is something seductive about sadness. We want to comfort the other person, and as Tourvel discovered, that desire quickly turns into love. Affecting sadness, even crying sometimes, has great strategic value, even for a man. It is a skill you can learn. The central character of the 18th century French novel Marianne by Marivaux would think of something sad in her past to make herself cry or look sad in the present. Use tears sparingly and save them for the right moment. Perhaps this might be a time when the target seems suspicious of your motives or when you're worrying about having no effect on him or her. Tears are a sure barometer of how deeply the other person is falling for you. If they seem annoyed or resist the bait, your case is probably hopeless. In social and political situations, seeming too ambitious or too controlled will make people fear you. It's crucial to show your soft side. The display of a single weakness will hide a multitude of manipulations. Emotion, or even tears, will work here too. Most seductive of all is playing the victim. For his first speech in Parliament, Benjamin Disraeli prepared an elaborate oration, but when he delivered it, the opposition yelled and laughed so loudly that hardly any of it could be heard. He plowed ahead and gave the whole speech, but by the time he sat down, he felt he had failed miserably. Much to his amazement, his colleagues told him the speech was a marvelous success. It would have been a failure if he had complained or given up, but by going ahead as he did, he positioned himself as the victim of a cruel and unreasonable faction. Almost everyone sympathized with him now, which would serve him well in the future. Attacking your mean-spirited opponents can make you seem ugly as well. Instead, soak up their blows and play the victim. The public will rally to your side in an emotional response that will lay the groundwork for a grand political seduction. Reversal. Timing is everything in seduction. You should always look for signs that the target is falling under your spell. A person falling in love tends to ignore the other person's weaknesses or to see them as endearing. An unseduced, rational person, on the other hand, may find bashfulness or emotional outbursts pathetic. There are also certain weaknesses that have no seductive value, no matter how in love the target may be. The great 17th century courtesan Ninon de L'Enclos liked men with a soft side. But sometimes a man would go too far, complaining that she did not love him enough, that she was too fickle and independent, that he was being mistreated and wronged. For Ninon, such behavior would break the spell, and she would quickly end the relationship. Complaining, whining, neediness, and actively appealing for sympathy will appear to your targets not as charming weaknesses, but as manipulative attempts at a kind of negative power. So when you play the victim, do it subtly, without over-advertising it. The only weaknesses worth playing up are the ones that will make you seem lovable. All others should be repressed and eradicated at all costs. Chapter 14. Confuse Desire and Reality, the Perfect Illusion. To compensate for the difficulties in their lives, people spend a lot of their time daydreaming, imagining a future full of adventure, success, and romance. If you can create the illusion that through you they can live out their dreams, you will have them at your mercy. It is important to start slowly, gaining their trust and gradually constructing the fantasy that matches their desires. Aim at secret wishes that have been thwarted or repressed, stirring up uncontrollable emotions, clouding their powers of reason. The perfect illusion is one that does not depart too much from reality, but has a touch of the unreal to it, like a waking dream. Lead the seduced to a point of confusion in which they can no longer tell the difference between illusion and reality. Fantasy in the Flesh. In 1964, a 20-year-old Frenchman named Bernard Boursicot arrived in Beijing, China, to work as an accountant in the French embassy. His first weeks there were not what he had expected. Boursicot had grown up in the French provinces, dreaming of travel and adventure. When he had been assigned to come to China, images of the Forbidden City and of the gambling dens of Macau had danced in his mind. But this was communist China, and contact between Westerners and Chinese was almost impossible at the time. Boursicot had to socialize with the other Europeans stationed in the city, and what a boring and cliquish lot they were. He grew lonely, regretted taking the assignment, and began making plans to leave. Then, at a Christmas party that year, Boursicot's eyes were drawn to a young Chinese man in a corner of the room. He had never seen anyone Chinese at any of these affairs. The man was intriguing. He was slender and short, a bit reserved, but he had an attractive presence. Boursicot went up and introduced himself. The man, Shi Pei Pu, proved to be a writer of Chinese opera librettos who also taught Chinese to members of the French embassy. Aged 26, he spoke perfect French. Everything about him fascinated Boursicot. His voice was like music, soft and whispery, and he left you wanting to know more about him. Boursicot, although usually shy, insisted on exchanging telephone numbers. Perhaps Pei Pu could be his Chinese tutor. They met a few days later in a restaurant. Boursicot was the only Westerner there. At last, a taste of something real and exotic. Pei Pu, it turned out, had been a well-known actor in Chinese opera and came from a family with connections to the former ruling dynasty. Now, he wrote operas about the workers, but he said this with a look of irony. They began to meet regularly, Pei Pu showing Boursicot the sights of Beijing. Boursicot loved his stories. Pei Pu talked slowly, and every historical detail seemed to come alive as he spoke, his hands moving to embellish his words. This, you might say, is where the last Ming emperor hung himself, pointing to the spot and telling the story at the same time. Or the cook in the restaurant we just ate in once served in the palace of the last emperor. And then another magnificent tale would follow. Pei Pu also talked of life in the Beijing opera, where men often played women's parts and sometimes became famous for it. The two men became friends. Chinese contact with foreigners was restricted, but they managed to find ways to meet. One evening, Boursicot tagged along when Pei Pu visited the home of a French official to tutor the children. He listened as Pei Pu told them the story of the butterfly, a tale from the Chinese opera. A young girl yearns to attend an imperial school, but girls are not accepted there. She disguises herself as a boy, passes the exams, and enters the school. A fellow student falls in love with her, and she is attracted to him, so she tells him that she is actually a girl. Like most of these tales, the story ends tragically. Pei Pu told it with unusual emotion. In fact, he had played the role of the girl in the opera. A few nights later, as they were walking before the gates of the Forbidden City, Pei Pu returned to the story of the butterfly. "Look at my hands," he said. "Look at my face. That story of the butterfly, it is my story, too." In his slow, dramatic delivery, he explained that his mother's first two children had been girls. Sons were far more important in China. If the third child was a girl, the father would have to take a second wife. The third child came, another girl. But the mother was too frightened to reveal the truth and made an arrangement with the midwife. They would say that the child was a boy and it would be raised as such. This third child was Pei Pu. Over the years, Pei Pu had to go to extreme lengths to disguise her sex. She never used public bathrooms, plucked her hairline to look as if she were balding, on and on. Boursicot was enthralled by the story, and also relieved, for like the boy in the butterfly tale, deep down, he felt attracted to Pei Pu. Now everything made sense. The small hands, the high-pitched voice, the delicate neck. He had fallen in love with her, and it seemed the feelings were reciprocated. Peipu started visiting Boursicot's apartment, and soon they were sleeping together. She continued to dress as a man, even in his apartment, but women in China wore men's clothes anyway, and Peipu acted more like a woman than any of the Chinese women he had seen. In bed, she had a shyness and a way of directing his hands that was both exciting and feminine. She made everything romantic and heightened. When he was away from her, her every word and gesture resonated in his mind. What made the affair all the more exciting was the fact that they had to keep it secret. In December of 1965, Boursicot left Beijing and returned to Paris. He traveled, had other affairs, but his thoughts kept returning to Peipu. The Cultural Revolution broke out in China, and he lost contact with her. Before he had left, she had told him she was pregnant with their child. He had no idea whether the baby had been born. His obsession with her grew too strong, and in 1969 he finagled another government job in Beijing. Contact with foreigners was now even more discouraged than on his first visit, but he managed to track Peipu down. She told him she had borne a son in 1966, but he had looked like Boursicot, and given the growing hatred of foreigners in China and the need to keep the secret of her sex, she had sent him away to an isolated region near Russia. It was so cold there, perhaps he was dead. She showed Boursicot photographs of the boy, and he did see some resemblance. Over the next few weeks, they managed to meet here and there, and then Boursicot had an idea. He sympathized with the Cultural Revolution, and he wanted to get around the prohibitions that were preventing him from seeing Peipu, so he offered to do some spying. The offer was passed along to the right people, and soon Boursicot was stealing documents for the communists. The son, named Bertrand, was recalled to Beijing, and Boursicot finally met him. Now, a threefold adventure filled Boursicot's life: the alluring Peipu, the thrill of being a spy, and the illicit child whom he wanted to bring back to France. In 1972, Boursicot left Beijing. Over the next few years, he tried repeatedly to get Peipu and his son to France, and a decade later, he finally succeeded. The three became a family. In 1983, though, the French authorities grew suspicious of this relationship between a Foreign Office official and a Chinese man, and with a little investigating, they uncovered Boursicot's spying. He was arrested and soon made a startling confession. The man he was living with was really a woman. Confused, the French ordered an examination of Peipu. As they had thought, he was very much a man. Boursicot went to prison. Even after Boursicot had heard his former lover's own confession, he was still convinced that Peipu was a woman. Her soft body, their intimate relationship, how could he be wrong? Only when Peipu, imprisoned in the same jail, showed him the incontrovertible proof of his sex, did Boursicot finally accept it. Interpretation. The moment Peipu met Boursicot, he realized he had found the perfect victim. Boursicot was lonely, bored, desperate. The way he responded to Peipu suggested that he was probably also homosexual, or perhaps bisexual, at least confused. Boursicot, in fact, had had homosexual encounters as a boy. Guilty about them, he had tried to repress this side of himself. Peipu had played women's parts before, and was quite good at it. He was slight and effeminate. Physically, it wasn't a stretch. But who would believe such a story, or at least not be skeptical of it? The critical component of Peipu's seduction, in which he brought the Frenchman's fantasy of adventure to life, was to start slowly and set up an idea in his victim's mind. In his perfect French, which, however, was full of interesting Chinese expressions, he got Boursicot used to hearing stories and tales, some true, some not, but all delivered in that dramatic yet believable tone. Then he planted the idea of gender impersonation with his story of the butterfly. By the time he confessed the truth of his gender, Boursicot was already completely enchanted with him. Boursicot warded off all suspicious thoughts because he wanted to believe Peipu's story. From there, it was easy. Peipu faked his periods. It didn't take much money to get hold of a child he could reasonably pass off as their son. More important, he played the fantasy role to the hilt, remaining elusive and mysterious, which was what a Westerner would expect from an Asian woman, while enveloping his past and indeed their whole experience in titillating bits of history. As Boursicot later explained, quote, Peipu screwed me in the head. I was having relations, and in my thoughts, my dreams, I was light years away from what was true, unquote. Boursicot thought he was having an exotic adventure, an enduring fantasy of his. Less consciously, he had an outlet for his repressed homosexuality. Peipu embodied his fantasy, giving it flesh by working first on his mind. The mind has two currents. It wants to believe in things that are pleasant to believe in, yet it has a self-protective need to be suspicious of people. If you start off too theatrical, trying too hard to create a fantasy, you'll feed that suspicious side of the mind, and once fed, the doubts will not go away. Instead, you must start slowly, building trust while perhaps letting people see a little touch of something strange or exciting about you to tease their interest. Then you build up your story, like any piece of fiction. You have established a foundation of trust. Now the fantasies and dreams you envelop them in are suddenly believable. Remember, people want to believe in the extraordinary. With a little groundwork, a little mental foreplay, they will fall for your illusion. If anything, err on the side of reality. Use real props like the child Peipu showed Boursicot. And add the fantastical touches in your words, or an occasional gesture that gives you a slight unreality. Once you sense that they are hooked, you can deepen the spell, go further and further into the fantasy. At that point, they will have gone so far into their own minds that you will no longer have to bother with verisimilitude. Wish fulfillment. In 1762, Catherine, wife of Tsar Peter III, staged a coup against her ineffectual husband and proclaimed herself Empress of Russia. Over the next few years, Catherine ruled alone, but kept a series of lovers. The Russians called these men the Vremyanchiki, the men of the moment. And in 1774, the man of the moment was Grigory Potemkin, a 35-year-old lieutenant, 10 years younger than Catherine, and a most unlikely candidate for the role. Potemkin was coarse and not at all handsome. He had lost an eye in an accident. But he knew how to make Catherine laugh, and he worshipped her so intensely that she eventually succumbed. He quickly became the love of her life. Catherine promoted Potemkin higher and higher in the hierarchy, eventually making him the governor of White Russia, a large southwestern area, including the Ukraine. As governor, Potemkin had to leave St. Petersburg and go to live in the south. He knew that Catherine could not do without male companionship, so he took it upon himself to name Catherine's subsequent Vremyanchiki. She not only approved of this arrangement, she made it clear that Potemkin would always remain her favorite. Catherine's dream was to start a war with Turkey, recapture Constantinople for the Orthodox Church, and drive the Turks out of Europe. She offered to share this crusade with the young Habsburg Emperor, Joseph II, but Joseph never quite brought himself to sign the treaty that would unite them in war. Growing impatient in 1783, Catherine annexed the Crimea, a southern peninsula that was mostly populated by Muslim Tartars. She asked Potemkin to do there what he had already managed to do in the Ukraine, rid the area of bandits, build roads, modernize the ports, bring prosperity to the poor. Once he had cleaned it up, the Crimea would make the perfect launching post for the war against Turkey. The Crimea was a backward wasteland, but Potemkin loved the challenge. Getting to work on 100 different projects, he grew intoxicated with visions of the miracles he would perform there. He would establish a capital on the Dnieper River, Yekaterinoslav, which means to the glory of Catherine. That would rival St. Petersburg and would house a university outshining anything in Europe. The countryside would hold endless fields of corn, orchards with rare fruits from the Orient, silkworm farms, new towns with bustling marketplaces. On a visit to the Empress in 1785, Potemkin talked of these things as if they already existed. So vivid were his descriptions. The Empress was delighted, but her ministers were skeptical. Potemkin loved to talk. Ignoring their warnings, in 1787, Catherine arranged for a tour of the area. She asked Joseph II to join her. He would be so impressed with the modernization of the Crimea that he would immediately sign on for the war against Turkey. Potemkin, naturally, was to organize the whole affair. And so, in May of that year, after the Dnieper had thawed, Catherine prepared for a journey from Kiev in the Ukraine to Sebastopol in the Crimea. Potemkin arranged for 7 floating palaces to carry Catherine and her retinue down the river. The journey began, and as Catherine, Joseph, and the courtiers looked at the shores to either side, they saw triumphal arches in front of clean-looking towns, their walls freshly painted, healthy-looking cattle grazing in the pastures, streams of marching troops on the roads, buildings going up everywhere. At dusk, they were entertained by bright costumed peasants and smiling girls with flowers in their hair dancing on the shore. Catherine had traveled through this area many years before, and the poverty of the peasantry there had saddened her. She had determined then that she would somehow change their lot. To see before her eyes the signs of such a transformation overwhelmed her, and she berated Potemkin's critics. "Look at what my favorite has accomplished. Look at these miracles." They anchored at 3 towns along the way, staying in each place in a magnificent newly built palace with artificial waterfalls in the English-style gardens. On land, they moved through villages with vibrant marketplaces. The peasants were happily at work, building and repairing. Everywhere they spent the night, some spectacle filled their eyes. Dances, parades, mythological tableaux vivants, artificial volcanoes illuminating Moorish gardens. Finally, at the end of the trip, in the palace at Sebastopol, Catherine and Joseph discussed the war with Turkey. Joseph reiterated his concerns. Suddenly, Potemkin interrupted, "I have 100,000 troops waiting for me to say go." At that moment, the windows of the palace were flung open, and to the sounds of booming cannons they saw lines of troops as far as the eye could see, and a fleet of ships filling the harbor. Awed by the sight, images of Eastern European cities retaken from the Turks dancing in his mind, Joseph II finally signed the treaty. Catherine was ecstatic, and her love for Potemkin reached new heights. He had made her dreams come true. Catherine never suspected that almost everything she had seen was pure fakery, perhaps the most elaborate illusion ever conjured up by one man. Interpretation. In the 4 years that he had been governor of the Crimea, Potemkin had accomplished little, for this backwater would take decades to improve. But in the few months before Catherine's visit, he had done the following. Every building that faced the road or the shore was given a fresh coat of paint. Artificial trees were set up to hide unseemly spots in the view. Broken roofs were repaired with flimsy boards painted to look like tile. Everyone the party would see was instructed to wear their best clothes and look happy. Everyone old and infirm was to stay indoors. Floating in their palaces down the Dnieper, the imperial entourage saw brand new villages, but most of the buildings were only facades. The herds of cattle were shipped from great distances and were moved at night to fresh fields along the route. The dancing peasants were trained for the entertainments. After each one, they were loaded into carts and hurriedly transported to a new downriver location, as were the marching soldiers who seemed to be everywhere. The gardens of the new palaces were filled with transplanted trees that died a few days later. The palaces themselves were quickly and badly built, but were so magnificently furnished that no one noticed. One fortress along the way had been built of sand and was destroyed a little later by a thunderstorm.